Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, May 20th, 2013. Will you be my friend on Facebook, please? I was taking a look at my page. It's Peter B. Collins Show, if you haven't been there, and I could use a few more likes. If you haven't done it already, just drop by, click like, and my self-esteem will go right through the roof. And I wanted to open today by pulling back the curtain on Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg's political action committee called FWD for forward, FWD.us. And that is the web address of the organization. And it is nominally a group of tech millionaires and billionaires in Silicon Valley, just down the road from me, whose primary focus is immigration reform. In fact, you hit the homepage, and it's not a very impressive website, I have to say, for for the product of the heavyweights of Silicon Valley. It's not too impressive. But it opens with a picture in black and white that appears to be a group of immigrants arriving at Ellis Island. It's undated, but by using black and white, they're telling us it's a picture from the past. And the headline reads, "Join the tech community in passing immigration reform." Then it invites you to submit your email address or to connect using Facebook. Fancy that. And it's in big, big, headline-style presentation. Now, this is all well and good. Mark Zuckerberg has every right to spend his billions promoting a political agenda of his choice. And we don't know that much about the politics of this 29-year-old man. But he held a fundraiser for New Jersey Governor Chris Christie earlier this year. And then he launched Forward, or FWD.us. Now, already, two of his cronies in Silicon Valley, notably Elon Musk, who is a PayPal billionaire, he is the founder of the Tesla electric car company. He is a major player in the private space company called SpaceX that's been launching rockets. And Elon Musk pulled out of Forward.us without a real detailed explanation. But I have a hunch it's about the offshoot of Forward, which is called Americans for a Conservative Direction. And I invite you to go to Forward.us and take a look, because they've hired some of the biggest guns in politics from both political parties to advise them. And apparently their advice is to pander to right-wing Republicans and get them off their amnesty message by using sympathetic conservative leaders to promote what they consider to be a reasonable approach to immigration. Now, I have pointed out before that I believe their agenda is, it starts and ends with getting more H-1B visas. And these are the visas for tech workers, scientists, engineers, who can be either retained in the United States after they graduate from MIT or Stanford, or can be imported from India or elsewhere to take a job in Silicon Valley. And overall, I think this is a reasonable thing to do. I don't think we should have unreasonable barriers to entry to this country. But it's fair to say that this displaces American workers who otherwise might get the job, and that non-Americans who rely on the company for the work permit, the H-1B visa that they hold, are more pliable, more compliant, less likely to join a union or to demand a raise. And so this fits the model in Silicon Valley, which is almost entirely union-free, and it permits these employers to operate with greater flexibility than they might with American citizens and taxpayers. So, first up, we have a commercial, which is one of the first two launched by Americans for a Conservative Direction, And by the way, I've heard a radio version of the commercial you're about to hear on the Rush Limbaugh nationally syndicated radio show. So they are consciously trying to reach out to the Neanderthal wing of the Republican Party and get people on board for immigration reform. So here comes Senator Marco Rubio, the thirsty and freshman senator from Florida.
Anyone who thinks that what we have now in immigration is not a problem is fooling themselves. What we have in place today is de facto amnesty.
Conservative leaders have a plan, the toughest enforcement measure in the history of the United States.
They have to pass the background check. They have to be able to pay a registration fee. They have to pay a fine.
Border security on steroids. Tough border triggers. And no giveaways for lawbreakers.
No federal benefits, no food stamps, no welfare, no Obamacare. They have to prove that they're gainfully employed.
Bold, very conservative. A tough line on immigration.
It puts in place the toughest enforcement measures in the history of the United States, potentially in the world. And it once and for all deals with the issue of those that are here illegally, but does so in a way that's fair and compassionate, but does not encourage people to come illegally in the future and isn't unfair to the people that have done it the right way.
Stand with Marco Rubio to end de facto amnesty. Support conservative immigration reform.
So this is very interesting. First of all, Marco Rubio is the son of Cuban immigrants, and he is a rising star in the Republican Party. The most interesting part of this commercial is how they're trying to revive the word amnesty, which they have completely poisoned by calling any effort to reform our broken immigration system. That's what they say. By the way, that's their language, fixing a broken immigration system. I think we all agree that it's broken. But Republicans have obstructed any intelligent approach to dealing with these issues by saying that it's all amnesty. If you let people get a green card, that's amnesty. And if you don't seal up the border, that's amnesty. I mean, it's incoherent. But if you listen to what they're arguing here, it's that this is such a tough bill and that the benefits for non-citizens won't go into effect until we have, border enforcement on steroids. That's the language they use. Well, this is a pitch to bring the Republican Party base along on something they don't want to do. The nativism that has been accentuated by political campaigns of the last 10 years is alive and well. And so Republican leadership, recognizing that they are on a course for their own extinction, have recognized that they've got to moderate this policy. But they have to bring along the far-right elements that they have been stoking for so long. So it creates this very bizarre message. Funded by Silicon Valley millionaires and billionaires who don't care about amnesty, don't care about the Mexican border, they don't have any scientists that they know of who snuck in by swimming the Rio Grande River. And so this is a very cynical approach to trying to win passage of a bill that can also win in the House of Representatives, which is where the real conservatives are. So the Marco Rubio ad is not nearly as offensive as the one you're about to hear next. And this may be why Elon Musk said, forward, I'm out of here. But this is a commercial that makes a hero out of Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
When Lindsey Graham's in Washington, what does he do? He stands up for South Carolina values.
Change you can believe in after this health care bill debacle has now become an empty slogan. And it's really been replaced by seedy Chicago politics.
I'm not going to be intimidated by this president. What I am suggesting is that we work smart and we work together. We're about to spend $1 trillion sometime tonight, maybe. If this is change that we can believe in, count me out.
And the president says, I'm for all the above when it comes to energy. Those are words coming out of his mouth. They don't come from his heart. No Keystone Pipeline, no drilling in the Gulf. At the end of the day, the economy is not doing well.
Call Senator Graham. Tell him to keep fighting for South Carolina.
So this is a very interesting and deeply offensive commercial. Lindsey Graham is not up for re-election right now. So running commercials on South Carolina television, making a hero out of him. And keep in mind, the purpose of this group is to pass immigration reform that is favorable to Silicon Valley employers. And to do that, they think they need Lindsey Graham so badly that they're willing to trash Obama on health care reform. And you know I'm not a big fan of Obamacare, but to use it as a political football in the immigration debate is pandering of a very low order. Then to talk about the Keystone XL pipeline and drilling offshore, what the hell does that have to do with Silicon Valley's immigration issues? So I find this fascinating, and I will continue to monitor the efforts of Mark Zuckerberg's political action team called Forward.us. But their initial efforts seem to be incredibly cynical, and they are pandering to the most extreme elements in American politics, somehow hoping that by, you know, promoting the Keystone XL pipeline, drilling in the Gulf, and opposing Obamacare, that is going to get them to ease up on immigration reform if it has the stamp of approval of people like Marco Rubio. Paul Ryan appears in the radio commercial with Rubio that I referred to, and this one for Lindsey Graham. And there's also one running in Alaska supporting Democratic Senator Mark Begich, which calls for drilling in the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge Area, the Arctic Wildlife Refuge Area, ANWR, which has been a hot-button issue for environmentalists for many years. So that's what I got for you on the Zuck Pack right now. More as it breaks right here at peterbcollins.com. In a very in-depth interview released today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com, we initially took on the story of whistleblower Robert McLean. He worked as an air marshal, first for the FAA and then for the TSA when the Transportation Security Administration was formed. And he left after blowing the whistle over policies in his department and over a breach where he was told not to fly at a time when there were terrorist risks reported. And in this clip from the interview, you hear his attorney, Tom Devine, who is the legal director for the whistleblower advocacy group called the Government Accountability Project. And he talks about the importance of Robert McLean's whistleblowing and his efforts to get a better whistleblower protection law last year.
The initial ruling in Mr. McLean's case got right down to what is the role of an individual in the government. The administrative judge started out with the premises that Mr. McLean was acting in good faith to better protect our country. The judge second concluded that he had succeeded in his goal. The judge third concluded that the only disruption to the agency was the administrative burden of correcting the mistake when the agency said it was going to mistakenly abandon the country during an Al-Qaeda attack. Nonetheless, the administrative judge said this was a fireable offense because as an individual government employee, he was taking actions that changed the authority and the choices of agency management, and it's their authority to decide how to spend their resources. And even if it means abandoning the country, the principle of management control rather than individual frontline employees having a voice trumped the public policy priorities. It's almost surreal to me.
That's attorney Tom Devine from our in-depth interview released today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And as I advise you in an opening statement in this podcast, it didn't turn out quite as I expected, because after I read Peter Van Buren's article about whistleblower McLean, I invited McLean for an interview. He said, I want to bring my attorney, Tom Devine. I said, fine. And then I sent Van Buren's article about McLean to other whistleblowers I know. And I heard back from Joe Carson, the Department of Energy whistleblower, who didn't have much of a beef with McLean or his story, but has a kind of feud with Tom Devine and the way that the Government Accountability Project does or does not protect the whistleblowers it represents. And so in the interview with McClain and Devine, I raised some of Carson's issues. I also heard from Julia Davis, who had worked in the Department of Homeland Security, blew the whistle there, and was subjected to incredible retaliation. Well, unbeknownst to me, she has been following McClain's case for years, and in 2011 she wrote a critical article about it. So, in the interview with McClain and Devine, I brought up the issues raised by Carson and by Davis, and they responded to them. And then I decided, in fairness, that I should talk to Carson and, if she wanted to, Julia Davis. Julia Davis declined, but gave me a written statement, and you'll hear that at the beginning of segment two of the podcast. And Joe Carson invited David Pardo, a former FAA employee who left under whistleblower circumstances and has become a sharp critic of Tom Devine and the Government Accountability Project. The bottom line here is that I didn't expect this kind of internal fighting in the whistleblower community. I have heard complaints from whistleblowers about Gap and Pogo, and I also have, you know, seen a little bit of critical back and forth in the past, but nothing like this. So I proceeded to interview Carson and Pardo, and you can hear their criticism of whistleblower attorneys, including Tom Devine, including the Government Accountability Project. And it's all there for you to absorb. And in the end, I invite you to share your comments with me and tell me if you think I was fair, because Robert McClain has already surfaced his own complaints that he thinks my process in doing these interviews wasn't fair. So you, the listener, will be the ultimate judge, and I look forward to your commentaries. Peter at peterbcollins.com is the email that always works to reach me here. Today, the Hearst Corporation, which owns the San Francisco Chronicle and a number of other papers across the country, including the San Antonio Express News, has published an important story, part of a series based on a 7-month investigation by the San Antonio paper into sex crimes and rape in the military. And it is very well done, well reported. I recommend it to you. I want to read one passage that is a very powerful summary. Victims of sex abuse in the military confront a system in which the investigators charged with pursuing their cases treat them with suspicion, rape kits are lost, guilty confessions are disregarded, and jury verdicts can be vacated with a stroke of a commander's pen. Few suspects face criminal punishment. Of 3,374 reports of sexual assault last year involving 2,900 accused offenders, only 302 went to courts martial. That's about 10%. And 238 were convicted. Now, 268 offenders received non-judicial or administrative punishment or discharges, allowing them to dodge a criminal mark on their record. Now, this number of 302 courts martial is right around 1% of the total number of cases estimated by a confidential poll of people serving in the military, which shows a total of 26,000 cases of sexual assault or harassment last year alone. So the article goes on. In 70 cases, suspects slated for possible courts martial were allowed to quit their jobs to avoid charges. Prison sentences are rare. Only 177 perpetrators were sentenced to confinement. But the most jarring statistic, about half of all convicted sex offenders were not automatically expelled from the armed services. There's much more in this story, and I invite you to follow it at the San Francisco Chronicle's website, which is sfgate.com. Well, the inquiry into the flap over at the IRS continues. Today we learned that the chief White House lawyer, Catherine Ruemmler, knew for over a month that the Treasury Inspector General had concluded his audit of the IRS targeting of conservative groups weeks before the matter became public. So the obvious cover-up question has to be, what did the president know? When did he know it? And the senior staff of the White House is saying they knew, but they didn't tell the president. Not exactly sure why, and we'll wait to see if this turns into further embarrassment or fodder for the Republican witch hunters who are alive and well in Washington these days. But the American people seem unfazed. A CNN poll released over the weekend, 61% of Americans say President Obama's comments about the IRS were mostly or completely true. 55% say the IRS acted on its own. On the Benghazi scandal, 50% believe that early statements about the attack reflect what the administration believed at the time, compared with 44%, and of those, 76% are Republicans, who say officials intentionally misled the public. When it comes to Benghazi, to me, the big issue is very clear, that the CIA was running the show at that installation in Benghazi. And so far, Daryl Issa and the other Republicans in Congress have not taken steps to investigate the CIA's role. They keep hammering the State Department, and the reason is that Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. And they're trying very hard to diminish her prospects for a campaign in 2016 by using Benghazi as their cudgel. And Rush Limbaugh was busy fulminating about this again today and focused on the question, where was Obama last year on the evening of September 11th when the report started coming in that the facility in Benghazi, it wasn't a full consulate, was under assault? And the answer is, I don't know. And I'm not sure it's important, but the Republicans are desperately trying to use innuendo wherever they can to raise doubts about this. And I've already told you, I believe the White House did engage in a cover-up, and I believe it was primarily to protect the interests of the CIA, which also clearly ran the control of the talking points that were ultimately used that got UN Ambassador Susan Rice in so much trouble. And to its credit, there is a congressional hearing underway today in the Senate about Apple Computer and its tax status. Apple appears to be the biggest tax avoider of corporate America today. And this Senate hearing revealed that some divisions of Apple's business are set up so that they are stateless. No, not paperless. That would be fine for Apple, but they're stateless. They are exempt from taxes, record-keeping laws, and the need for the subsidiaries to even file tax returns anywhere in the world. Now, this takes the Enron accounting schemes that took that company under to a new extreme. We don't know if their partnerships have cute little names offshore, but, for example, in 2011, one subsidiary paid the nation of Ireland 1/20 of 1% in taxes on $22 billion on pre-tax earnings. 1/20 of 1%! Another did not file a corporate tax return anywhere and has paid almost nothing on $30 billion in profits since 2009. Altogether, Apple's tax avoidance efforts have shifted at least $74 billion from the reach of the Internal Revenue Service. Now, that's a little more important than the tax-exempt status for phony political groups, isn't it? I sure think so. The New York Times has an advance from the statement that should be delivered by Apple CEO Tim Cook before the Senate subcommittee on Tuesday. In it, he says that Apple is likely the largest corporate income taxpayer in the U.S., having paid nearly $6 billion in taxes to the U.S. Treasury last year, and that Apple does not use tax gimmicks. All right, let me check something out here, will you? Siri, does Apple use tax gimmicks?
Would you like me to search the web for does Apple use tax gimmicks?
Sure, Siri, get right back to me, will you, sometime before Tim Cook testifies. Well, Siri's going to search the web and see what she can find. That, of course, is on my Foxconn 5 Apple iPhone. The president has announced that he will give a speech this Thursday to lay out his wide-ranging counterterrorism policy, from the controversial use of drones to efforts to close the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. And I'm looking forward to this speech. It'll be at the National Defense University in Washington. And he's got a lot of explaining to do. One of his minions from the Pentagon went before Congress on Friday and said that because we haven't wiped out al-Qaeda, that the so-called war, it's not the war on terror anymore, will continue for another 10 to 20 years with the concurrent cutbacks in our civil and constitutional rights and the incredible defense spending, all that stuff. But this advance leaked from the White House says that he's going to tell us that Al-Qaeda has been seriously degraded and that Al-Qaeda's core has been weakened, but that new dangers have emerged. He will review the detention policy and efforts to close the facility at Guantanamo Bay and frame the future of our efforts against Al-Qaeda, its affiliates, and adherents. We'll be watching with great interest what the president has to say. We've learned that Chinese hackers have breached some of the servers at Google and been able to uncover which accounts Google has warrants from the United States government to monitor. Now, if you remember Mad Magazine and their old cartoon, Spy versus Spy, this is rich, because Chinese hackers were able to access a database that includes information about court orders authorizing surveillance. And so, for example, if there's a court order to monitor a Chinese government official, it's on file at Google to monitor that person's Gmail account, and now Chinese hackers have discovered that. Somebody's got to tell the spooks that just because they call something secret doesn't mean that it stays secret. Finally, today, like you, at least I think so, I get irritated when I'm on an airplane and they tell me that I have to turn off my gizmos. They tell us because our personal electronic devices, or portable electronic devices, PEDs, can give off radio frequency signals that might compromise pilots' communications, navigation, or surveillance systems. I have never believed this. I think that it is a matter of controlling the passengers. And I think there's a reasonable cause to tell people that during takeoff and landing, the riskiest points in flight, that we don't want you distracted, we don't want you all wired up with earbuds and other gizmos in case we have to evacuate the plane in a crash landing. That's the most reasonable argument that I can muster for telling people to turn off their gadgets at the beginning and end of flights. And I think I revealed to you that once last year, I used my cell phone from a plane to send a text message because the plane was circling the airport and we were delayed. And it worked. The plane didn't crash. The pilot didn't come on the intercom and say, "Hey, that guy in seat 12A, don't use your phone." And as you know, many people inadvertently leave their phones turned on in a pocket or a handbag or a carry-on bag, despite the efforts of the flight crew to get you to turn them off. And the Washington Post is running a story today that tries to explain that Kenneth Kirchhoff, a research and development engineer with Boeing, is the point man on this. And he makes a very weak case that it's possible. He doesn't say it's happened. He doesn't say it's probable. He said it's possible that your use of a phone or other wireless device might be more powerful than they expected and could disrupt the critical communications of a commercial airliner. Get back to me with a little proof on that, will you, Mr. Kirch? What's your Kircher? Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until